On the Empire Podcast this week, the Smaug levels are rising as we get our teeth into the second part of Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy and talk to two of its stars, Luke Evans and Richard Armitage. Plus, yes, we can hear you, Matt Berry. The star and writer of Toast of London drops in for a chat. All that and much, much more on the only movie podcast that is simply delighted with the revelation that the supervolcano underneath Yellowstone Park is twice as big as previously thought, which means not only are we all doomed, but that Roland Emmerich has to go back and remake 2012. Win-win, I think. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, I'm joined by a trio of people who frankly weren't doing anything better. That's a lie. We're impressed today. We could all be doing something better. Anyway, I was going to be joined by just one colleague, but splitting everything into three is all the rage these days. So, first up is our Queen of the Geeks, a woman who's forgotten more by talking dragons than most of us will ever know. It's Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How do you feel about this Yellowstone revelation?
It's a little worrying, I'll be honest. I do want to go there someday. I would like to see.
Didn't you go there?
I went to Yosemite.
Yosemite.
Yeah, and that gave me a taste for wanting to go to Yellowstone. But yeah. I would clearly be taking my life into my hands.
Well, I don't think it's going to blow up without warning.
Well,
so I think we'll be okay.
I've seen 2012. There wasn't much warning.
Are we in danger of giving them an idea for Yogi Bear 3?
Where he stops a caldera.
Yeah. That's all right. That's Yellowstone. Yellowstone, completely different place.
Okay. You just heard him there. He's our art house guru, a man so dedicated to the art of subtitles that even now he's working on subtitles for this very podcast. Just press 888 on your camera phone or podcast listening device now. How's that working out for you?
You have to press wheat.
Oh, wheat. I forgot about that.
Quadruple wheat.
And last but not least, is the ever-bouncing, ebullient podcast editing machine that is Sir Alistair Plum.
Hello,
Alistair.
Want to do the Seinfeld voice?
Hello, la la la.
Can I just chip in and say I'm still recovering from yesterday's astonishing art house quiz that you put together for me?
Should we put some context to this?
Yeah, do it.
Phil had a birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, Phil.
Thanks.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. What we usually do in the Empire office when people have birthdays is I compile a speech for them that usually involves a quiz revolving around their surname. Phil has this frankly silly surname that means you can't really test him on it because there aren't many descendants out there in the world. So instead, I came up with an art house round of quiz up that we played live with Phil and his brother Nick. How was it, Phil?
It was tense. I'm exhausted today. I'm a shell of a man.
I think
it could be because of my advanced years as well, but also because
trois
couleurs blanc de blanc.
Yes,
as I'm liking to call this thing. It's an astonishing quantum leap forward in birthday quiz technology.
Give people a sample of the questions. What tripped you up?
What tripped me up?
I'll tell you what tripped you up.
Wait, it'll come back to me. One of them was. This is embarrassing. What won Best Foreign Film this year?
Yeah.
I completely forgot.
Yeah.
Apparently it was Amour.
It was Amour, yes. How much were The Wages of Fear in The Wages of Fear?
I got that one right, though.
You got that one right, but yeah. that was a good question.
The Order of the Three Colours trilogy tripped both you and Nick.
You didn't specify it was before or after tax.
That is true, but neither did they in the film.
Red, orange, green.
It is red, orange, green, yeah. As it should be. But yeah, I think if Alexander Armstrong, you know, falls into a pit or is imprisoned in a dungeon near my flat, I'm not saying I don't have a dungeon in my flat. I keep it near my flat for tax shelter purposes. I'm available to host Pointless. I think most people have
already
used the word Pointless in relation to me over the years. So yeah, why not?
Okay. Pointless? And
Do you not know what Pointless
Armstrong?
Is?
Alexander Armstrong. Is he the guy from Armstrong and Miller?
Yes. Yes, and he was severed from Ben Miller, and he went off to do a quiz show called Pointless, which started out as a daytime thing on BBC, and has now turned into this phenomenon. It's huge. It has, you know, this celebrity version, it has a primetime version. It's massive, and the idea is that you have a category, and then you have to. It's essentially that Family Fortunes thing. We surveyed 100 people, and they said this. So they have a category that's like Coldplay songs. And you have to name songs that people won't have said. So you have to get the pointless answer. Oh. So you wouldn't say Clocks by Coldplay, you would say a deep.
So the opposite of Family Fortunes?
Yeah, kind of. But it's still got a Family Fortunes tinge.
They wanted to call it Family Misfortune, but they
Yeah.
So you want to hear them go, that noise. You want that?
No.
Oh.
You don't.
Let's come back to this.
I feel we've gone off the beaten track a little bit. Sorry for that pointless debate, everybody. That we will get on with the podcast right now because it's time to tackle your questions. As ever, you've been sending them in all week via Facebook, Twitter, and email. Let's start with a Twitter question. This is from @RichardBud41. He asks, which sequel is most guilty for basically remaking the original? Home Alone 2 seems the obvious example.
The second most obvious would be one that you should be aware of. Evil Dead 2 kind of sort of remakes the entirety of Evil Dead 1, but then does add a lot more to it at the same time.
Oh, well, remakes Evil Dead 1 in the first 5 minutes, and then Evil Dead 3 remakes kind of both movies, but essentially Evil Dead 2 inside the first 3 minutes. It's a nice little way of doing a recap, I would say.
Arguably, of the three, there's about one movie in there.
Oh, yeah, but it's, God. Why it's are the, you baiting
it's
him?
The best movie ever made, so why are we even having this discussion? Why?
Let's move on from that one, shall we? I'm going to put forward Shrek, because every single Shrek movie, including the sort of half-hour Christmas and Halloween specials, basically has the same plot, which is that Shrek is grumpy boots and decides he wants to be alone and then realises that it's nice to have other people around too.
Yes.
Every single one.
Yes.
All of them.
Yeah, good point.
I'm thinking about
James Bond.
I'm thinking about Bond in a good way, unlike Helen, who's thinking about it in a bad way.
Very bad way.
Bond has specific examples of when they take the same plot beat. I mean, obviously there will be super spy James Bond versus big bad guy, hot girls, fast cars, special gadgets. Like, that's something we all know about, right?
Yeah.
But when you have A View to a Kill, that's quite a lot like Goldfinger in its structure. Then you have Die Another Day, which is almost exactly like Diamonds Are Forever. That one is intentional. Other ones are just strangely similar. It kind of cannibalises itself over and over and over.
And Honor Majesty's Secret Service is the one that sort of stands out as doing something completely different. But otherwise, they do seem to kind of retrace the same formula. And why not? I guess why not with those sorts of films? But then a film like a Bourne sequel has a overarching arc which takes it forward in different directions as well. So, or Star Wars.
I noticed some similarities between Never Say Never Again and Thunderball. I don't know if anybody else has spotted that, but there were
revolutionary.
A few touches.
Oh,
there.
Hang on. The guy who played James Bond in Never Say Never Again looks a lot like the guy who plays James Bond in Thunderball.
Yeah, but he had some kind of prosthetic crinkly makeup.
Yeah.
Or something.
He's much more Scottish in Never Say Never Again than he is in Thunderball as well. I almost wish Connery kind of did try an English accent as Bond in his early years, and then I love that he just gives up. Never Say Never, you know, he's in that phase, that fuck it phase, where he just does whatever he wants.
He's been in the fuck it phase for the past 40 years.
You're Sean Connery, yeah, precisely. You can afford to do that.
Why not? I mean, lots of sequels do it. The Hangover 2 especially. I think 3 they tried to do something different, but 2 is very much a replay. And this may be controversial, Chris, but Taken 2, let's be honest, it's not that different from the first one.
Except the family's involved, and it's in a foreigner. Oh, no, it is the same.
No, it isn't.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you want your sequel to feel like the first movie, but some of them do absolutely just retread it. Home Alone 2 is one. Die Hard 2, to an extent, even has that line, that famous line, how can the same shit happen to the same guy twice?
Yep.
But if you up the ante, I'm happy
enough
with that.
Well,
if you kind of push it a little bit further, like you look at the Jaws movies. No, okay, I'm not happy with that. But Godzilla, for example, which we'll get onto later, like you just take the same construct and you just throw more at it. It's a robot Godzilla. Look, it's a flying pterodactyl the size of Manhattan. You know, you don't really begrudge it that. But things like Meet the Parents, then Meet the Fockers, I can't really excuse that. And also Star Trek Into Darkness and Wrath of Khan.
Yeah,
pushes glasses up nose.
It's one of the reasons why I'm such a big defender of Ocean's 12, because that goes out of its way to do everything that you wouldn't expect a sequel to do. It locks up its main characters for the big heist at the end, which is just one of the things that, and obviously gets criticised for the whole Bruce Willis, Julia Roberts cameo thing. Yeah, halfway through, but I like it. It takes risks. It's fun. It's playful.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Ali, with that you have to up the ante. But I think the problem is when you keep doing that and it all gets just ridiculous. I mean, I think that's especially true of action movies where they're tied to some kind of real world limitations of space, time and physics. And you get to a point where you can't go any further. Like Fast and Furious 6 suffered from a bit of that this year, because you can't go much bigger than Fast and Furious 5 without getting really, really stupid. And I think, to an extent, most action franchises suffer from it at some point. So I think then what you want to do, ideally, at some point, is you need somebody to come in, give the whole thing a good kick up the butt, and do a, you know, either completely change genre in the way that the Alien franchise has occasionally done, or, you know, at the very least, you know, reinvent the tone in the way that, say, Fast and Furious 5 did. Or even, and I can't believe I'm bringing this up, but like the Step Up franchise has kind of changed the way it approached the films during the time. It has.
I can't believe I'm bringing this up.
I know, I'm so sorry. But it went from being a sort of, you know, two-hander, you know, teen love story to being some kind of weird group zeitgeisty trying to be thing, which at least, you know, you've got to give it credit for trying, although not for succeeding.
Horror franchises are quite guilty of this, aren't they? Like Paranormal at the moment just seems to be making the same film over and over again. And there's no diminishing appetite for it either, it seems. Saw is a bit the same, isn't it?
Saw reinvented itself.
I'm saying that having
times.
Not seen any of the Saw films.
good, excellent. No, Saw has an incredibly complicated narrative. It's not just a simple. It's not just a case of remaking the same film over and over again. If you watch all seven films, it's extraordinarily complex.
Is it? Yeah. Well, I apologise to all concerned.
Good.
Sorry,
good.
Everyone. Sorry, Saw.
I'm not saying they're good necessarily. I thought, I have a soft spot for the first three, but yeah, it's not. It's not just a case of
a hard and warty spot for the last however many there are. How many other?
800.
800.
No, only seven. Only seven, which is quite restrained for a horror franchise.
This isn't a new development though, or a relatively new development. I'm just thinking the Magnificent Seven franchise. They kind of remade the same film more than once.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
It's a formula. They wanted to get big stars doing heroic things in the West, and they just wanted to do it again afterwards.
Yeah,
and everyone wanted to see it, I suppose. So it's been around for quite a long time.
Those visible Dirty Dozen sequels.
Dirty Dozens.
Laurel and Hardy didn't exactly reinvent the wheel each time, although they did usually trip over it each time. So I suppose there's that.
The Smurfs 2 was interesting this year because, you know, the first movie was a, this pretty knockabout animated family film. And the sequel was a dark sex comedy, which I was surprised.
Yeah.
Michael Fassbender, I thought, was very, very brave to be in that film.
Yeah. Was he Papa Smurf?
The level of nudity in that movie just took me by... Hang on.
No.
Are you thinking of Shame?
I might be thinking of Shame.
Yeah.
I hear that they're doing Albert Camus' L'Étranger as the basis for the third, which will see most of the Smurfs locked up and questioning the meaning of life for about an hour and a half.
That would be amazing.
Like the audience.
I could watch that.
Hell is other Smurfs is the tagline.
That would be amazing. Okay, we're moving on now to an email question. This one is from Paul Millward. It's a very long question. He goes, after watching Old Boy, I realised I really cannot stand Charlton Copley as an actor. Oh, that's not fair.
Oh, mean.
That's not fair. Even though I like most of his films I've seen, he's ridiculously over-the-top, whole bacon sandwich worth of hammy actor, and yet everyone else seems to love him. So I was wondering if any of you had any opinions on films, actors, directors that you think you are the only person to hold that opinion on. What I guess this means, someone who's universally beloved, or a film is universally beloved, and yet there's someone in this room who thinks it sucks.
Oh, a film as well.
Yeah, film, actor, director, he says.
I think the people I dislike as actors that kind of get under my nerves a bit and mix my metaphors with a big spoon are the ones that kind of everyone is ragging on, and it feels a little unfair to poke them again, but I can if you like. Catherine Heigl, I wouldn't necessarily want to spend a whole dinner party with. David Spade, I don't love. And Tobey Maguire, though he can be brilliant sometimes, I find with Tobey Maguire, he's kind of like, you have to spend 50 minutes getting into the Tobey Maguire zone, and then you get used to him on screen as part of the rest of the ensemble or whatever, and then you go, okay, I'm fine with this. But for the first 50 minutes, you go, oh, he's so Maguire-y.
Get into his zone. That sounds like the world's worst sci-fi concept. It's a post-apocalyptic wilderness, the Tobey Maguire zone. And you have to cross... Anyway, I've lost my train of thought.
You have to cross something. Yeah.
You cross stuff to get there.
You really are getting old.
I agree with you about Tobey Maguire, actually. I feel a bit that way about him as well.
And his Spider-Man best bud / love interest, Kirsten Dunst, isn't my...
I guess it says, you know, the question is about, are you the only person to hold that opinion? So this is the I hate Star Wars thing, or the... is there anyone here who dislikes... Jason Statham? I mean, can we imagine such a person?
What? No.
No such person exists. For example, I'm not a huge fan. I think, Phil, you feel the same way about Jay Baruchel. How do you pronounce his name?
Baruchel.
Do you really want to know?
Yes.
Banana.
Jay Banana?
Yeah.
Phil, how, you know...
I've been accused of being a Jay Baruchel bully just Banana. In the last few days. Banana.
Yeah.
And that too, actually, weirdly. I just feel like bullying a bit because he's kind of small and you know, unthreatening. But I'm not a fan at all of Jay Baruchel. I find him really whiny and irritating as a screen presence.
Yes, but I think a lot of people feel that way. So that's, yeah, I don't know. That's really the answer to the
question. He's a very nice person in real life. I know.
Which is very disconcerting. But yet, in films like Cosmopolis, largely this is the end, and I can just tell from seeing the trailer of RoboCop.
She's out of my league.
Yeah, I just want to pretty much drop a wardrobe on him in every single every single film he's done. Even How to Train Your Dragon.
Oh, no.
Willow.
No.
Yeah.
Willow.
That would be a much better film if Hiccup had just been crushed by a wardrobe.
You are a mean man.
How to Brain Your Dragon Rider.
Oh. I'm not a big fan of Leslie Mann. I don't know if that would put me in a minority. You know, Helen's looking at me weird.
Wow.
I just find her really sort of, her screen presence is passive aggressive and just kind of unnerving.
Fine, your screen presence is passive aggressive.
Thanks, Chris.
I used to feel like I was on my own in being a Keanu apologist, but you know, a lot of people are kind of coming around to my way of thinking on that.
Yeah, and then along comes 47 Ronin.
Shut up! It's going to be awesome.
I'm kidding.
I know. I genuinely not only love Keanu, but I think he's underrated. I think he does, what needs to be done in his films, to an extent that you can't do if you can't act, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I don't think you make those films if you can't act.
And you take that one to the bank.
But for example, I mean, no one here thinks, I'm just plucking names out of the air, no one here despises Hugh Jackman, can't stand him, doesn't want to watch a film with Hugh Jackman in it.
What kind of person would feel that way?
Only a serial killer.
That's right.
Jeffrey bloody Dahmer.
He's kind to puppies and raises money for charity and, you know, hugs children and such.
What a git. Sorry, Paul Millward, I don't think we can actually answer that question to your satisfaction. Let's move on to Dan Blackburn with another long email question. In a time when every great terrible movie or novel concept is being turned into a franchise with sequels and prequels galore, what standalone film would you like to have been given a sequel? And he says, I'd have liked to see another Prince of Persia, you mentalist. And instead of Monsters University, surely Incredibles had a wealth of material and great characters to use, or maybe even a sequel to The Losers. The Losers? Nobody wants a sequel to The Losers.
I like The Losers.
Oh, I was...
Hey, my unpopular opinion.
Hey!
Perfect!
Which is like in a film everyone hates. Hey, you turned it around and said. Anyway, yes. Question. Answer. Go.
I would put on this list some movies that end with "ers." Sneakers, Rounders,
yep.
District Niners.
They've been trying to make a Rounders sequel for a long time. They've been talking about it.
True Lies, Jumper. There's those.
Really?
You really want to sequel to Jumper?
I really kind of want a remake of Jumper, is what I actually want. Yeah. I really like the idea. I thought its execution was terrible, but there's something there. There's a daydream fantasy, the Jumper fantasy, which just kind of taps into something in my brain, and I find myself thinking, hey, what if I could do that?
Is this just because you like jumpers?
I like jumpers and jumping. I suppose there is a connection.
Christmas jumpers would be good.
Yeah,
so you want a sequel to Jumper
Santa
and
Claus
Sneakers?
4. Yeah.
Pretty much working on the whole wardrobe there, aren't you?
Yeah.
Is there a film called Trousers?
The Wrong Trousers?
The Wrong Trousers. Get a sequel to that going. Well, there kind of was one, wasn't there, really?
It was a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I think if we ignore The Mask 2, I think The Mask could have easily had a sequel.
That'll go well with your jumper and sneakers?
Yes, it will. Will it? I look a little like a serial killer at this point.
You might do.
You won't be able to do anything in this one, but this is another Urs movie, which is Master and Commander, which was just, we've talked about this before, but it's incredible that it was even made, so I'd love to see if it would even be made again. And again, this is one of those ones like Jumper, which isn't really I want a sequel for it, but I'd almost just like it to be done properly, which is League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It's not even like I dislike the cast, it's just that, again, there's so much potential, and there's that another daydream thing of, you know, what if Dorian Gray, you know, was part of this team, and I just like that idea. And Serenity, I could see, if anybody actually watched that film, a sequel would have been well received, certainly by me.
End of that.
We do have there have been a few movies over the last few years where the film hasn't done well, but then has done very well on home video and has obviously then garnered a sequel. Usually comedies, Austin Powers, and of course Anchorman is about to come out. That didn't do that well the first time around. It's about to get a sequel. I think it's going to be huge. So you never know. But I think Joss Whedon's in a different place now.
I think we know about Serenity. It's not going to happen. Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that ship has flown off into the sunset. I mean, a couple of those, they talked about sequels for a long time. True Lies is something that they talked about on and off over the years. And actually, in the question, I mean, they mentioned The Incredibles. That's something that there have definitely been discussions about at Pixar. Brad Bird's talked about it, but has said, you know, until we are absolutely sure we have a a killer concept, then they're not going to touch it, which is, I mean, is inarguably the right decision, but we'd just like them to come up with that killer concept already, please and thank you.
The monsters thing is an interesting example, because I felt like the monsters sequel, whilst fun and diverting, made the mistake of, I think what was great about Monsters Inc., it didn't take with it, you know, the central concept was so brilliantly put together and conceived, and it didn't benefit from having that. So any of those films that have that kind of strong central conceit, I was thinking The Adjustment Bureau is quite fun, and that might lend itself to
I
a
love
nice
The
sequel.
Adjustment Bureau,
the idea of that, you know, where you could take these doors.
And then there's a hat for Ali to wear with his mask.
I was
going to
say, The Adjustment Bureau, you could put your sneakers into, along with your mask and your, what else? Help me out.
And my boots.
I've forgotten.
And my jumper.
Yeah.
Your kinky boots. Kinky boots could have a sequel.
I'd also would like to see another movie in the world of The Fifth Element. Obviously, The Sixth Element would make perfect sense. I'd watch The Sixth Element. And also, of course, History of the World needs a part two.
It does. I love Master and Commander as an idea, and I know that we've discussed that on this podcast before, but it will never happen, but that would be great, and there's a wealth of material for them to use, so someone make that film, please.
Maybe somebody will make Temerara instead, which is Master and Commander with dragons.
There she goes, the talking dragons again.
That's right.
I'm not going to contribute much to this, because you can pretty much guess what I'm going to say.
Evil Dead.
Event Horizon!
Event Bloody Horizon. yeah, that would be interesting. And for a long time, every time a talk of a sequel to John Carpenter's The Thing came up, I was kind of quietly rooting for it. Because even though it has one of the great endings, I do want to see Kurt Russell as MacReady come back and kick some more alien butt. And I would like to see something like that. I know Frank Darabont was working on a sequel that was going to be on the, I think it was on the Sci-Fi Channel, and then it all went south. That led down the road, it eventually led to the prequel, but... maybe one day.
Went south to Antarctica.
It went south, yeah. It's clever. And of course, Kurt Russell, you know, the hair is a bit grey these days, but, you know, he hasn't aged. Apart from that, just dye his hair black, he could still be RJ MacReady.
Do you want him to escape from somewhere else as well?
No, not really. Moving on now, obviously, if you want to send in questions to us, we're on Twitter at Empire Magazine. Please use the hashtag Empire Podcast or we won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, of course. Do give us a like. And you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first interview of this week's pod. If you're a fan of British comedy, this guy will have been on your radar for some time. He first made a splash as part of Garth Marenghi's Dark Place and The Mighty Bush before moving on to the IT crowd. He's now the star and writer of his own Channel 4 sitcom, The Gloriously Surreal Toast of London, and he's also the owner of one of the finest voices in showbiz. He is, of course, Matt Berry, and he came in to talk to Nick DeSemlian and myself earlier this week. We are delighted to be joined in the Empire Pod booth by Matt Berry, star and writer of Toast of London. Hello, sir.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us on a Monday morning. I have to say, Nick and I are huge fans of Toast of London.
You're very kind.
And it just got a second series.
It did, yeah.
Yeah. So where were you when you heard the news?
This time last week, I was just getting out of Blackfriars train station. Do you know Blackfriars train station? It's the new one. It's across the Thames. It's actually really good. Anyway, I just come back from rehearsing for Vic and Bob's new sitcom, which I've now done. So they told me, but they did this thing which I think they found very funny, which I found less amusing, which is the Simon Cowell approach of, you know, sort of breaking news.
Oh yeah.
So I had this whole hi Matt, and I thought, I thought, oh god, here we go. And they said, I'm afraid to say, and I was like, just do it. And they said, that you'll have to do it all over again next year. Which I then thought was hilarious.
Excellent.
I mean, there was already some pretty crazy stuff in the first one. Is there stuff that's even more kind of extreme? Do you feel now you can go a bit wilder?
Well, I don't think it's that kind of crazy, which is a good or a bad thing.
I'm thinking largely of the Bruce Forsyth riff, which I found hard to forget. I kind of woke up, I had a weird dream after I watched that episode.
I know, it gave a lot of people nightmares, that one. The we can't deviate, I mean, we've been told this, we can't really sort of deviate from the tone and the format. You know, for instance, we can't take him into space or whatever, which is something that I wanted to do.
T-
Toast of space, that would be nice, yeah.
So, yeah, you know, we've got to keep it, you know, kind of sort of looking and sounding the same, which is fine, because, you know, that's, you know, it is the show, you know, that, you know, we both kind of wanted to make, so that's good news for us.
Mm. Where did the idea for the Bruce Forsyth, the Nigerian lady who gets plastic surgery, which makes her look exactly like 1970s Bruce Forsyth?
Yeah, well, it had to look like 1970s, because if it looks like Bruce Forsyth now, it's just a guy with bits of real white hair. And just like an old man. We had the same discussion with Andrew Lloyd, you know, with Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah.
From the back, how, you know, if you do him how he looks now, it's just an old guy, you know, with, like, you know, sort of like grey hair, looks like everyone's dad. Mm. So he had to look like he does when he's at his peak, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Yeah.
So it was 1970s Lloyd Webber as it was Bruce Forsyth. That was the reason why it's, you know, and that's how I think of him as being 1970s.
Do you think Bruce, the real Bruce, may have, this may have reached him, word
well,
of the...
Well, it's funny you should mention it, because we filmed Vic and Bob in Elstree in Studio 9, and next to that is the George Lucas studio, where they do Strictly Come Dancing.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been in the same area, and I met his PA, but I didn't mention it. I don't want to, you know what I mean? I would imagine he's still, you know, quite kind of powerful, so...
He'll come after you.
I don't want to wind him up just yet.
I remember I took a picture of that whenever the episode was on TV and tweeted it.
Oh, right.
Saying, you know, this is... It was phenomenal makeup, but it was just one of the funniest things I've seen in a long, long time.
Yeah, well, it kind of hinged on that. If that makeup hadn't have been as good as it was, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
And we didn't know, so it was just like, oh, God, this has to work. Otherwise, we're in trouble. Yeah, and it was all right. It worked out.
So the interesting thing about Toast is that even though it does have quite surreal flights of fancy and quite surreal things like happen like that, the Bruce Forsyth thing, it seems to be rooted in a certain kind of reality. A lot of things in the show happen to you, or certainly in terms of how actors... I remember reading an interview where you said that, you know, it's about how actors respond to other actors' success.
So. Yeah, that is just things that I've kind of noticed. And, I mean, he's not, you know, he's too aware of his, you know, kind of, you know, kind of... you know, sort of career, and he thinks he should be a lot, you know, kind of further up than he is, whereas I'm just kind of lucky to be doing as far as I'm concerned. So there's no kind of similarities, you know, like, you know, sort of between us. There isn't, as far as we both do lots of voiceover.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things that kind of happen to him, you know, kind of taken from things that have happened, if you know what I mean.
So do you have a real life Clem Fandango?
They're in every recording studio. There's one of those in every one. I mean, there really is. And I mean, like, I've never lost it in one, but I've been in a voiceover with another actor who has lost it, and it's intense because it's a small area, and it's a small area over there as well.
Yeah,
it was quite something, and it just stuck in my head, you know. And that's, you know, where a lot of the ideas of
bloody hell, what happened, can you say?
He just didn't like what he was being told. He was being, you know, kind of directed. I didn't give a monkeys, because it was, you know, an in and out thing, and it wasn't anything, you know, that anybody, you know, would kind of hear.
Yeah,
I didn't think so. It didn't bother me, but he was quite concerned with being told how to, you know, sort of pronounce certain words, and in the end, he just kind of, like, you know, sort of like flipped, and yeah, I'll never forget it. It was hilarious.
You obviously have one of the most majestic, if not the most majestic, voice in show business.
No. I'm way down the list. Tom Baker's got the most.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, have you heard the Tom Baker meltdown type? Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, like, he was doing that in every job, I think.
I was curious whether you kind of, you know, you have a special drink that you have to, or warm up at exercises or anything like that. Do you just go in and just talk?
Yeah.
There's no secrets.
There's no secrets. I don't think it's that good. You know, I think it's ridiculous. Yeah. You know, I'm just, you know, always, you know, kind of glad, you know, and kind of, you know, sort of, you know, kind of like surprised to be paid.
Right.
Each time.
Yeah. Garth Marenghi's Dark Place particularly. I love your voice in that, and the way it's kind of out of sync.
That was 10 years ago. That was the first thing I ever did.
There's an event happening next month.
Is there?
Where they're screening the whole thing. I had a cinema in London.
Is there? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Matt's coming down and doing a talk afterwards.
Good on him.
I was curious, when the four of you were last in a room together, do you see those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I saw Rich. We did the last IT Crowd together, which was like a month or so ago.
Mm.
Okay.
That's when it was broadcast, yeah. It strikes me as, I can't believe it's 10 years since Dark Place. And it seems to be striking you as equally strange.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the first thing you did. How did that come about?
I was doing music and thought that's what I would do. You know, the best I thought that would happen would be that I'd be dropped from several record labels. I thought, you know, if I do that, that's all right. So, you know, I just like doing songs. And then I ended up doing songs before the Boosh went on, because I knew Noel. Then I ended up doing Rude Ones because, you know, it was, you know, a comedy show type thing. And it just went from there. And then Matt and Richard came down and also did stuff and kind of said, you know, if this thing we've just done in Edinburgh, if it goes to TV, do you want to play this Spanish doctor? And I was like, you know, I'm doing that. Yeah. You know, I was, you know, on my arse at that point. So, you know, yeah. That's, you know, where it all came from.
Wow. So in terms of you were very much finding your way, I guess, as an actor for that one?
No, I wasn't finding it. No, I didn't necessarily want to be an actor. Yeah. No, I was just, you know, I just didn't want to work, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so doing songs and, you know, and I was working in the London Dungeon, you know, and I was like temping anything, you know, to not do some kind of, you know, sort of career-based sort of 9-to-5 thing.
Right.
That was just the plan. It was about what I didn't want to do, I think, then.
Yeah.
Working in the London Dungeon sounds like an interesting job. Was it an interesting
job? I loved it. I loved every minute.
Yeah.
I was there for a year, I think. Yeah, because I'd done pretty miserable temp jobs. And, you know, I was in a room, you know, kind of sorting out people's parking fines, you know, and I was doing telesales, you know, where as soon as you finish one call, another one gets pumped straight in. It's awful stuff. And then a mate said, you know, there's some auditions, you know, kind of happening for the London Dungeon. You know, you get to kind of, you know, sort of like dress up, you know, and kind of muck around all day. You know, it sounds right up your street. And I was like, yeah, yeah. So I went down, did an audition, which I kind of sort of, you know, sort of like made up on the spot. Because I hadn't really done auditions, you know, before that. And then, you know, I got the job and then that was it. I was in there. I was in the dungeon.
What were you dressing up as?
Well, you do different things during the day. So, say, in the morning, you'll be Jack the Ripper. In the evening, you'll be the judge.
I'm Jack the Ripper this morning.
Yeah, and then, you know, then you have lunch. You know, then you're the judge in the afternoon.
This sounds like a sitcom in itself.
It was good. I mean, you know, might put taste in the dungeon.
And you've kind of infiltrated movies in a weird way, because your voice was in Moon.
I mean, you know, you got to look very kind of carefully, but I'm there.
Yeah.
With Benny Wong.
Yeah. Mm. And in the film Dread, which came out recently.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Snuffbox theme tune
turns
up, which I haven't heard you talking about that. But
because I don't know much more than that, you know.
Right.
It's the director liked the show and wanted to feature it in some way, and that's how he did it, I think.
So in the future, that is a big, big hit. It's like
a
track that survives. Are you personally responsible for the character names, or did you spitball more?
We both do. We both love people's name. Like Arthur's always been into that. Like his Noel Early in Father Ted, which is one of my favourites. And it just so happens, you know, that I'm equally into those kind of names.
Ray Purchase.
Yeah, I had that one quite a while ago. Ray Purchase and Cliff Promise were. Yeah, ones that I had a couple of years ago.
And Clem Fandango seems to have
Clem
almost
Fandango
become the show.
Is Arthur's.
That seems to almost have become the catchphrase for the show. Is
I
that
know.
Something you've experienced to people now?
Yeah, it wasn't the intention.
I saw Edgar Wright tweeting it the other day.
I know, yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, kind of by no means the intention. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
we had Daniel Radcliffe on the show last week. Which
Who?
Makes so you think he's in some sort of Potter thing? I'm not quite sure, but which makes you the second person in a row on the podcast to have guested on a Duckworth Lewis Method album.
Oh right, okay.
Both albums, actually. I'm a huge fan of the Duckworth Lewis Method. How did that come about for you?
I've known Tommy for years, and Hannon. Tommy asked me to be on the first album, spoken word thing.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't very sort of clear with, you know, like what he wanted to begin with. He said, just do some spoken word stuff over this song, Night Watchman, I think.
Mason on a Boundary, you're on.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, but it wasn't originally. It was
Night. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you were on Night Watchman. Oh, okay.
I was supposed to be on that.
Oh, okay.
And he hadn't sent a script with what he wanted, and that's what he's meant to do. So I just improvised this stuff about, you know, about making love, you know, in the, whatever you call the shed where you put the scores on. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
totally unsuitable for that sort of album. And they were, you know, like, politely went, yeah, but that's not quite what we... And then they, obviously, you know, then it became Mason and that speech. And then, yeah, and then the new one.
Yeah.
And I was supposed to be on the front cover of the new one.
Really?
Well, not my face, my... This area, just below my belt.
Right, okay, yeah.
But they couldn't do it because of a Wishbone Ash cover, which was too similar. So it was shot, and it was all kind of ready to go. And it had to be, with you know, like, withdrawn at the last minute.
Really? Yeah. In favour of the streaker picture that they've used.
Yeah.
So somewhere out there, there's a picture of...
No, they use it for the single. It's on the single.
On the single, okay.
Yeah.
I should check that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've been in, not in concert with them, but I saw them a couple of years ago at the Royal Festival Hall, but you came on and performed Mason on the Boundary. So
that's right.
Is that something that, you know, you just like to turn up and just do your song and you go?
Tommy's band Pugwash, I mean, they came on tour with us this year, you know, and they're coming on tour with us next year.
Okay.
I wanted to ask a little bit more about Garthmerigi's Dark Place. It's not very often we have a cast member in the house. It's whenever there's a conversation about TV shows that finish before... people feel that they should have.
Right.
That always comes up for me, anyway. Mm. Do you feel that there should have been more of it?
I don't know. Probably at the time when we found out that we weren't going to get a second series, yeah, I probably would have said then, yeah. But looking back, I don't know. I think, you know, I mean, maybe there's enough. I think it's quite expensive as well because it was shot on film.
Mm.
And there was no fake film then, in those days, like it was ages ago. But there was... You know, there was no... Well, I mean, there was, but it didn't look great.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I mean, Richard was very keen that it looked like film, you know, so, you know, we kind of had to use film. I don't think that's a reason why I didn't come back. I mean, like, I don't know.
But, I mean, the fan base has grown and grown for that I feel, anyway.
So I've heard, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you look back, was that a fun experience making it?
Yeah, because it was the first thing, you know, I ever did, yeah. You know, I loved every... You know, I mean, I loved every minute of that. I'd never done anything like that before. You know, you got to kind of, you know, sort of dick about, you know, and be paid for it. You know, wear masks and all that kind of stuff. Mm. Yeah, you know, I had a rattle time.
I feel like the song must have been a highlight, shooting the kind of the music video.
Yeah,
where you were...
in my pants. Yeah. No, that was good fun.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Are you saying that you don't consider your voice to be that great?
Well, no, but like, I don't hear it how you hear it because it's in my head. So for me, it just sounds like, you know, like a, you know, like a low tone, annoying. But you know,
but you know, it is. You're always popping up, as you said, on voiceovers and on commercials. And I have this thing where if I'm watching a advert break, I try and guess the voice behind the commercials, and it's either you or Peter Serafin.
Well, you say that.
That seems to be the case.
No, but I tell you something for nothing. Because I also do that. And a lot of times, well, fairly recently, since I've been very busy, you know, like not being, you know, like not being free sort of during the day, I hear a lot of things which I'm told are me, yet I know they're not.
Really?
Yeah. And I'll get texts going, I just heard you doing whatever advert, and I said, that wasn't me. So there's some...
There's an imposter.
There's a cat out there who is who is doing the voice, and there's another guy who's doing it, but not doing it, you know, I can kind of tell.
A shadowy cabal of Matt
sound-alike.
Yeah.
Well, that alone tells you that...
Unless I'm mad and can't, you know, kind of, you know, remember being in these rooms, but it isn't. There's a few that, you know, I've been, you know, that have been, you know, brought to my attention, which are not me.
Well, Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Matt Barry there. Now, ordinarily, we'd take the opportunity to tell you about the release of the film or the DVD that our guest was here to plug. But what's the point of having a guy with that voice in your pod booth if you don't let him use his instrument, so to speak? So take it away, Matt Barry.
Hello, this is Matt Barry telling you to buy the Toast of London DVD, which is out now, certificate 15. There's F's and Jeff's and two C's. Don't let that put you off.
Okay, movie news time now. That was a weird way to say the word now, but anyway, let's move on. What do we have? What do you got? No.
I've got the excuse to play this.
Oh.
Godzilla.
Godzuki.
That's amazing. Right. A Godzuki movie is in the works. It's being... No, it's not. It's just not going to happen. It's not really news, but it's just that the Godzilla trailer arrived, and it is great, so please go and see it. It's, yeah. That beginning of the Amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer we saw last week, where he is flying from presumably some kind of plane-type thing, and he's hurtling towards the ground, is kicked to the curb by the Godzilla trailer, which has about, I don't know, 12, approximately a dozen... soldier-type men jumping out of a plane, trailing red smoke as they fly into this huge smoky morass of a metropolis, and lo and behold, right down beneath them is this gargantuan beast called called Godzilla, and it's just a great trailer, so go take a look.
Definitely. It is a good time for trailers, as is traditional, just before Christmas. All of next year's big films are suddenly releasing.
That's what Santa's doing at the moment.
That's what Santa's bringing us.
He doesn't work on toys anymore, he just cuts trailers.
It's the Edge of Tomorrow trailer. Thank you, Santa.
I will add some Inception Brahms to this bit. No need to thank me, children. I really like that trailer. It sets it up, but doesn't explain too much. Doesn't explain anything about the beast, where it comes from, the origins of the beast, or really give much of a clue at any of the huge city leveling action that Gareth Edwards, who I think is going to prove himself the real deal with this after Monsters. If you haven't seen Monsters, check out Monsters. I think this film could be something special indeed. And you know, people are obviously using this movie to rag on Roland Emmerich's version, rightly so, obviously. But let's not forget that movie also had a cracking trailer.
It had an amazing trailer with the fisherman on the wharf.
Yeah.
Oh, that was amazing.
It also had an amazing tie-in theme tune from Jamiroquai. Anybody remember it?
Yeah, yep. Deeper Underground.
Ooh, too much panic in this town, said JK.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, so he's going deeper underground. True. Which doesn't make any sense, because he just gets squashed. Yeah. What are you doing, JK?
Well, as it turns out, I mean, you can understand why he didn't know that in advance.
Well, also, he's an idiot.
Well,
he didn't get the note.
Look at his hat.
Stupid JK.
We've also got, in a very brief roundup, a series of... This is a very sequel-heavy podcast, but let's just go with it. Bad Boys 3 is in the works. The Safe House writer, David Guggenheim, is on scripting duty, so that is in the works. There is no Michael Bay attached just yet. Any thoughts, or should we move on?
I don't...
I mean, you know.
Well said. Beverly Hills Cop 4 is back on track. Bruckheimer has made a new deal with Paramount. Attached to direct is Brett Ratner. Attached to star is
Eddie Murphy.
Correct.
Hey.
So this was after the success, not really a success at all, TV pilot, which didn't quite work, where Foley's son, this was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, didn't like. You know, the green light is world on fire.
Am I right in thinking that never made it to air? Has that pilot not been seen, apart from Suits at whichever company it was?
As far as I'm aware, I've not seen it.
Yeah.
If there's a man who would have seen it through some nefarious means, it would have been James Dyer, but I don't think I have, so...
No, it's interesting because that was worked on by Sean Ryan, who was... he's worked on The Unit and The Shield previously. He's a very, very good guy, so... he makes very, very good shows, so I'm intrigued that one didn't quite make it. Apparently the scuttlebutt was that Eddie Murphy overshadowed Brandon T. Jackson, who was cast as a lead a bit too much.
And he is, it's the presence, Eddie. Give him that.
Is he going to play different members of the Foley family?
I hope so. The Fat Foleys.
Because that would be amazing.
That would be genuinely amazing.
Yeah, it would be amazing. And one should be a Foley artist, because it works on several levels, like The Matrix Revolutions.
I was using a coconut for that.
Yeah.
Peter Berg, you remember him.
He sunk the Titanic.
That's right. Yeah. He is developing another rundown. You might know the film starring The Rock as Welcome to the Jungle, and you might also know it because it saw Arnie kind of hand over the torch to The Rock in a very brief and fun cameo. So his rockness is not confirmed to be in this follow-up, but it is being planned. Apparently it's something Peter Berg is asked about a lot, and he has finally let slip that yes, there are more firm than you thought plans to make this happen, and that is, in my world, a good thing.
Definitely. I really like the first one. I think this is one of those ones where, again, it's done well on DVD, perhaps better than it did in the cinema, and that's why it's suddenly being talked about again.
Scary. It was back in 2003 when it came out. It's kind of crazy. 10 years and The Rock is still, he's keeping on rocking in the free world.
Is it going to have an Explosions in the Sky soundtrack?
I really hope so, to tie in with a Peter Berg Friday Night Lights type thing. We've also got a follow-up to our other story that Phil has regularly been bringing up for whatever reason, because we just love Queen. Freddie Mercury biopic. You may remember that Sacha Baron Cohen was earmarked to play the mustachioed microphone rocker, but that fell apart when Queen, as a whole, decided to not lend their songs to the biopic, which is pretty important when you're making a Freddie Mercury biopic.
This is because Sacha Baron Cohen wanted to make it a
edgier,
a no holds barred, R-rated, for want of a better phrase, 18-rated, delve into Freddie Mercury's ribald world, I guess.
And I can imagine why, you know, his close friends didn't really want to do a warts and all thing, to mention warts for the second time in this podcast. Directing this project will be Dexter Fletcher, who previously brought us the very rock and roll warts and all movie Sunshine on Leith, which is possibly the most cheer-you-up, chappy, have another bag of sweeties, lovely jolly film. So maybe this will be the same. Probably not. Starring as Mr. Mercury will be Q himself, Ben Whishaw.
This is interesting. I mean, I haven't heard him sing on film, I'll be honest, but I like him very much. He's a terrific actor. I mean, if all you've seen him in is Q, you've only seen a tiny, tiny fraction of what he can do. His Hamlet on the London stage was one of the great ones of this century. And he's been absolutely brilliant in you know, everything he's done, basically.
When he fell out of a window in Nathan Barley as Pingo and had his, you know, his gonads electrocuted on a regular basis. I mean, that's what made me think Mercury.
Yeah, yeah.
That he's had the genital electrocution work done that's required to hit those notes that Freddie can get.
Yeah.
So, you know, best of luck to him and hope it isn't too painful.
I wonder if he is going to do his own singing.
Or maybe they'll just
voice.
That is
I
a heck of a
thought it
voice.
Was Dominic Cooper, as I probably
you probably said on the podcast.
Disappointing for me, really, that didn't turn out to be true. But Ben Whishaw, I don't know, he's an interesting choice.
He certainly is.
Dexter Fletcher is probably a more interesting choice, really, because that sort of shows you the direction that they want to be taking this.
Poppy peppy
funny,
we will rock you kind of thing.
Just the songs and
Live
the
Aid
stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's good that Dexter Fletcher is also kind of getting, you know, stepping up and getting considered for bigger jobs like this. I think fair play to him.
Anything that gets him back in this pod booth,
absolutely,
is fine by us, because the man is an absolute blast.
More sort of sequel franchise news in the shape of Indiana Jones 5, or the Indiana Jones property, which has been Paramount and Disney have shaken hands on, if they can shake hands as studios, on a deal to which basically relinquishes control, if not all of the financial ramifications of another Indiana Jones film to Disney, which puts Frank Marshall and all of the Indiana Jones world into the Disney, huge Disney beast. Soon Disney will own all of us and this pod booth. If they want us, they can.
Yes, please.
come and get us. Yeah. This is what they call a come and get us plea.
Our starting prize is $4 billion, but we're prepared to come down.
We'll come down a little bit.
Yeah,
we'll come down a little
bit. About $4 billion, I think.
Yeah.
What have we got that they might want? We've got a balloon. We've got
our ready wit and
opinions.
Our keen minds.
We've got opinions.
Well, we've got a balloon.
We have a balloon. That's pretty much all we have.
So this, I think, means that there will be another Indiana Jones film. It's been bubbling away.
Can I get a high five and a yay?
No.
No, I didn't think
not
so.
Yet, because we're doing news. But later, maybe.
Maybe a hug?
Yeah, okay, on then.
A lovely hug.
But there'll be another film. But they're going to have to hurry up, because Harrison Ford, and he's not getting any younger, obviously,
is dead!
Oh, my God.
Is that the revelation? Is that what you're going to say?
Hang on.
Holy God. Ah! Break it. Oh, no. Sorry.
No. Sorry, you misread that.
Your page was upside down.
I mean,
sorry.
Seriously, talk about burying the lead.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
Really loud.
I worked on two levels, man. That was good.
I love it when people do that. That's like when Nick in the office goes, might tweet that later. Screw you, Nick.
Stop working on multiple levels, people. It's too much for me, my brain.
Let's get back to Indiana Jones.
So, what does this mean? What does this mean?
A remake, maybe a reboot. What if it's a new Indiana Jones?
Anything could happen. Anything could happen on this at this point. They've been talking about it, and they've got Jurassic Park happening, and there's Star Wars happening. It's all happening out there at the moment at Disney. So, who knows? But certainly, if they don't make it soon, whatever adventures that are out there for Indiana Jones are going to have to come to Indiana Jones, because he's going to be limited in mobility.
I think they're clearly working on it right now. Did you see the tweet from Frank Marshall the other day?
Frank Marshall is
saying, I'm back in the Indiana Jones offices. Being in the Indiana Jones offices on the Disney lot is a weird feeling. But that means that there are Indiana Jones offices on Disney right now, which means something is happening on Indy.
Do you think
right
so?
Now?
Just because they've got an office.
I think so.
Doesn't mean, who knows?
I think so.
But that man is—he's working on Bourne. He's working on or not Bourne, whatever it's going to be called. He's working on all sorts.
They should adapt the point-and-click adventure involving Atlantis, which is a cracking story. If you've not played it before, it's actually really good fun. So yeah, that is a good game,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Such a good with the U-boat and stuff.
Oh yeah,
I love that.
I have mixed feelings about this one.
So do I.
I think the three existing Indiana Jones movies are so perfect.
Mm.
I think to make a fourth would be a big mistake.
Yeah, I agree. Let's just stick with those three.
Also, a reboot of Indiana Jones, I just don't know. I don't know. It has to be Harrison Ford for me. I don't know, maybe involving something about... If you've ever heard about this, about these crystal skulls, really interesting legend, and I think maybe he could go after
crystal
those.
Skulls, tell us more.
Well, I have news. Juan Antonio Bayona has been set as the director for a World War Z/C sequel.
This is good news.
It is good news. Bayona has a pretty much flawless track record. Stuff like, obviously, The Impossible last year, but The Orphanage before that. So we know he can handle big scale, you know, disaster work. We also know that he can handle scary stuff and sort of individual drama as well. So I think he's a really good shout. The big question will be, where do they go from where we left the last film?
Yes.
Which I'm not going to say too much about if you haven't, you know, seen it yet. You probably should. It's a good film. It has nothing to do with the book. And will this one take anything from the book? I mean, really, it's all there for grabs. All of it. Every single story beat is sitting there waiting for you to adapt it. So why not have a go,
Just
Hollywood?
Start again, you think?
I don't know. It's a little bit difficult because I'm not sure how you do much. I mean, the book's best set pieces, you know, are kind of tied into the way that the zombies in the book work, which is slow.
Yeah.
And a lot of them wouldn't work with fast zombies. Like,
and of course,
the existence of the Lobo, the tactics that they use against the zombies, the Battle of Yonkers, all of this stuff. But there's got to be something you can take and do.
Yeah. Maybe the zombies devolve to become slow-moving zombies. And there, of course, there were, you know, yeah. Jerry Lane didn't exist in the book. There
True.
Were all sorts of different characters. You know, the Japanese section of the book I absolutely loved.
Oh,
I'd love
to see
that character whose name escapes me. I apologise to that fictional character. But Bayona is a horror director. And this is interesting. He has a horror background. He loves horror. He's very, very good at generating scares. The Impossible, even though it was ultimately a heart-wrenching and emotional drama, is also terrifying.
Yeah.
And I think he can really make this work on a zombie movie on a big, big scale. I really, really liked World War Z. It came very, very close to being my top 10 of the year, which surprised me because I'm a zombie purist.
It won me over. I was kind of expecting the worst going in because I'm a big fan of the book and it clearly isn't the book, but leaving that aside, it is a very good adventure film. But I think it would be right, I mean, talking earlier about changing genres, this would be one where you could change the genre and make this one more of
musical.
a musical horror movie, and it would be interesting.
I'm excited about this too. I think I like the first one, and I think there's plenty of places they can go.
Mm.
Paris, hopefully. The
catacomb
stuff is pretty amazing. He'd be great for that, all of the underground where the zombies are living and they have to go down and clear them out, kind of Second World War hand-to-hand combat style. The problem is, for the horror, is that this is very much established as a PG-13 type treatment, isn't it? So you can't really throw a lot of like Lobo hack and slash stuff into it.
You can't do the gore, but I think there is room to make stuff very, very scary without gore. So I don't know. I'm certainly intrigued, and we'll have to see where it goes from here.
Honestly, Peter Capaldi in action.
It's intriguing because we're about to discuss The Hobbit, the Desolation of Smaug, and that has an awful lot of violence in it and a lot of heads being lopped off and people being stabbed with arrows and whatnot, and that's a PG-13, so you can be intense.
And there was actually a story this week where some academics actually looked at R-rated movies compared to PG-13 movies in the States and found basically no difference between them in terms of levels of sex and violence. It's more the kind of window dressing around it. It's not so much levels of violence as levels of blood that makes the difference between the ratings. So anyway, you can do a lot, is what we're saying.
Absolutely.
Just one final story to finish off on, and that is the news that Terminator Genesis, as the fifth installment of the franchise is now called, may have a leading John Connor. And that John Connor is Jason Clarke, probably at this point best known for his role in Zero Dark Thirty, where he tortured people to get information. But he will now be the great white hope for mankind in the future ruled by the machines.
Good actor.
very good actor, and I kind of buy him as a leader of men. I've got to say, I think he's a very kind of big, you know, manly presence.
This will be what, the fifth John Connor?
I believe so, at least the fifth. I think.
Yeah, there's two in Terminator 2, Nick Stahl obviously in T3, Christian Bale.
Yep.
In Terminator Salvation, name I almost forgot there. That shows how much an impact that movie made on me. And Jason Clarke is the fifth
one.
Yeah. Okay.
It's an interesting one. They also, I mean, there have been rumors about Sarah Connor being Emilia Clarke or Brie Larson. Now, obviously, they're a lot younger than someone who would play Jason Clarke's mother in the same timeline. So we must be talking. Obviously, we're talking about split timelines. You know, present and future, if you will.
Maybe, or maybe John Connor goes back in time or to maybe John team Connor, up with his mum and become his own dad.
Oh, yuck.
Just throwing it out there.
Please don't. Never throw that. What I'm saying is, though, it looks like it might be a little bit more of an equal split between sort of present-ish and future-ish.
Okay. Intriguing. I just want to mention very, very quickly the news of Simon Pegg has joined absolutely anything. The Terry Jones movie that reunites most of the Pythons, not all of them, but... one's dead and Eric Idle hasn't committed to it, but this is an intriguing storyline. Mark Terry Jones's first movie for a long, long time. It's about an ordinary guy who is given powers by aliens. It means that anything he says and wishes comes true.
Robin Williams plays a dog, a talking dog.
Ooh. Done. Sold. That starts filming next year. Time now for another interview. We've got two more interviews to go. Here's the first one. With the desolation of Smaug hitting cinemas today, we decided to sit down with two stars of the new Hobbit movie. First up is Luke Evans. He's had a heck of a year. He was a bad guy in Fast and Furious 6. He made our 666 greatest horror movie characters list with his role as driver in No One Lives. He was cast as Dracula and the Crow. And now he's about to hit the big screen as Bard the Bowman in Peter Jackson's sequel. He was speaking to... Who was he speaking to? He was speaking to Phil.
Nick.
And Nick. Well, there you go. Enjoy.
We are very happy to be here with Luke Evans, aka Bard the Bowman, the first human character to be seen in the Hobbit trilogy and the first Welsh one.
That's right.
How are you doing?
I'm very good. Very good indeed.
Yeah, so the accent, was that your decision or?
No, it was Peter, Fran and Philippa's idea. I went on tape for Bard about 18 months before I actually had a recall. For the character, and when I had the recall, they said that they'd heard my accent on interviews I'd done online, on TV or whatever, on YouTube or whatever, and they thought that they thought my accent might work well with Bard, so they asked me if I would do the screen test with my own accent, and that's basically how it began, and the rest is history.
What did you have to do in your screen test? If you don't mind me
asking. I had to do the scene in... Where was it? It was in my house, which is changed.
Which is your big moment, kind of the big
it's
moment.
It's sort of changed now. It was the scene was rewritten quite substantially, so it's a different scene now to the one it was.
And we don't get to see you doing any archery yet in
not
this
really.
Film.
Not really. Just the beginning, when you first meet me, you see me with a bow and arrow, but then you don't see me after that. Because, you know, Bard's life when you meet him isn't really about being a bowman anymore, even though he has this amazing skill. He doesn't need it, really. He doesn't. His life is all about just making a bit of money, looking after his kids, and living day by day, hand to mouth.
Transporting fish around, lots of fish.
That only once does he do that. He does that only to smuggle the dwarves in. Usually, those barrels are empty. Those barrels are usually full of wine. You see, so you wouldn't want wine out of those fishy barrels, would you? After that,
are they real fish or not? We were talking about this before.
Yeah, they were real fish.
Wow.
Yeah. About half a ton of fish, I think.
Wow. So the dwarf actors must have had a few showers after.
They hated it. They absolutely hated it. Yeah, they stank for days. Yeah, it's not very nice.
And that Lake Town set is absolutely amazing. I mean, that must have been fun to walk around.
It was. It was lovely to walk around a set that, you know, you can just keep walking, turning corners, going over bridges and still not actually getting to the edge of the set. It was amazing. It really was that big. It was an insanely beautiful set when it was lit properly. And they used to have these little water pipes that would spray out very fine mist over, and the mist would just float on the top of the surface of the lake. So it looked like the lake was, you know, in the mornings when the water is warmer than the actual air and you get that mist. they could recreate that with these special misters that were just under the edge of the gangplanks. It was very, very clever stuff. And all that ice was all obviously fake, but there were pieces of ice everywhere. And all the guys did all day long was just move them around to make them be in the right places at the right time.
Was it kind of I mean, there's quite a lot of Bard gallivanting around Lake Town at pace. Was there any mishaps on your
own? Well, amazingly, I spent almost like a year and a half in it doing... running around, literally running over the rooftops, around the streets, over bridges, and I didn't fall in once. And then went back for the pickup 10-week pickup session earlier on this year, and the first take, the first shot of me running around a corner, and I just missed it, and I went straight in. It was unbelievable. They shot it as well. It's on the bloopers probably. Yeah, but that was the first time. I couldn't believe it. It was unbelievable. I was like, all that time I did it. Almost every day I was on that set, and then I didn't. And then I come back. See, I was out.
Out of practice.
Yeah.
Not match fit. And is it a forgiving crew in terms of laughing at your mishap?
Oh no, God! They all laughed. They laughed incessantly for about 10 minutes, and they filmed it. Yeah. So you know, no, but they're a lovely bunch. It's a very nice atmosphere on set. They're really, really nice people.
Now, you tweeted this morning a photo of the Hobbit Monopoly
set,
which has your photo on the front.
I know, mad, right?
Oh, are you going to get that for everyone for Christmas?
Yeah, I'm getting it tonight. Yeah, I've already ordered it. Yeah, it's awesome.
What's your Monopoly strategy?
I looked at the board, right, and I looked around and I realized that I am the third most expensive place on the board, behind Gandalf and then Bilbo. So not doing too badly because he's a pauper of a lakeman. Lake Town, you know.
Wait, so you're an actual property or an actual?
Well, I think that instead of there being streets on the Monopoly board, it's actually people.
Oh.
Just all the different characters. But weirdly, the houses you can buy are Lake Town houses, which is really cool.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
We were pondering whether instead of a dog, you can play as a warg or something. Have you, do you know what the little pieces are that you can play?
Yeah, there was like, there was a sword. I think it must be maybe Sting, maybe. Mm-hmm. Then there is there's a little miniature stone dwarf, and there was, I've forgotten the others. But, yeah.
But that's crazy, having your own board
game. Isn't
it
mad? I mean, yeah. It's bow and arrow. Yeah, bow and arrow. The what do you call the thing, the bow, quiver? Yeah. But yeah, it's...
That's pretty cool.
There's something, you don't think about it at the time, do you, when you do a movie like this, but... these things are made, you know, you're part of not just the film, but the whole thing that goes with the film. It's incredible. It really is special.
This is the first Christmas when you can go, okay, guys, who fancies a board game? Oh, here's one. I'm in it. If you land on me, I can shoot you with a bow and arrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Legally.
Yeah.
You automatically win if your face is on the
yeah,
front
exactly,
cover.
Yeah, I own everything, yeah.
Unless you change your name to Kamchatka and play Risk instead.
Mm,
I don't know.
Could do that.
And you've got Lego as well, so...
I have Lego as well, yeah, yeah. It's there's a restaurant chain in America, I won't mention it, but they have like Bowman pumpkin pie and Bowman's brew, which is this... chocolate pumpkin chocolate drink, and it was Lake Town tart and whatever.
Wasn't a fillet of fish.
No, there was no fish on the menu, thank God. Yeah, it's cool. It's very cool.
But you've come a long way, because only 3 years ago in Robin Hood, your character was Sheriff's Fug.
Yeah. 6 second debut.
So what happened in that 6 seconds?
So after that, I then went on and did Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll with Andy Serkis, which is when I first met him, played a very small role. Then I went and did Blitz and Tamara Drew. I did an indie called Flutter, which was never released, so no one's ever seen that. And then, yeah, it just come and went. They built, they got bigger and bigger. Every role sort of was a little bit larger, and some did really well and some didn't do so well. And, you know, it's the way, the world of an actor and films and stuff. And sure enough, this year has been the biggest year of my career so far, with Fast 6 coming out, doing really great business, and, you know, people really liked the role. And then, you know, The Hobbit finally coming out, it's a really big deal. And obviously I've just wrapped Dracula, which is my first title role for a studio film, and I'm off to do The Crow next. So, and I fitted in a little TV job there as well for the BBC, for The Great Train Robbery. So it's been a the busiest year so far, and they've been busy. So for me to say that, that's saying something.
We, not to say that we just researched by looking at your Twitter feed, because we went far beyond that, but we did spot a cover of the Men's Health magazine. Where the headline was Luke Evans's three power moves for career success. And I just wondered, what are they, like physical moves, or is it more just sort of tactical?
I don't know. I really probably need to read the article to see what they've pulled out of my interview that has found them three power moves. I don't know what they could be.
To rescue something sensible from a ridiculous question, what advice would you have for a younger you from 3 or 4 years ago, and B, for someone that wanted to break into acting and wanted to make a career out of it?
Well, if we said a younger me, let's say like 5 or 6 years ago, then that would have been just before all this crazy film stuff started. And I would have just said it was absolute nonsense that I was going to be doing what I was doing. And so maybe a younger me, I would have just said, you know, keep at it, which I already had been keeping at it for a good 10 years. And it wasn't always plain sailing, you know. And it sometimes is dismaying as an actor because you don't work or you don't get the job you want. But who was to know that this was going to happen? So I probably would have just said, stick at it, kid. You know, it's going to work out. And for anybody who's thinking of becoming an actor, I'd probably warn them that it's not easy. It's not an easy business, and there's a lot of setbacks, especially early on in your career. And I think those setbacks early on in your career that either make you or break you, and you either become stronger from not getting the job, or you can't deal with the pressure and you leave the business. So if you're ready for it, if you're prepared for setbacks, then you'll do much better than people who are not, who think it's all going to be delivered to them on a silver plate, because it's not. It rarely happens like that. Most actors you see work very hard and have downtime when they have to take other jobs, which I've done, and it's not plain sailing. Just people just see you successful and they assume you've always been successful, but that's not the case. And so if you choose to do it, it's a lifestyle, it's a whole change of life, really, and it's very precarious and unpredictable, but you have to embrace that part of being an actor. That's part of the reasons why I do what I do, because I don't know what I'm going to be doing after The Crow. I have no idea. That's the exciting bit, you know. Who knows? It's exciting. Hopefully there'll be something, or maybe there isn't. Maybe this is it.
What can you tell us about The Crow and Dracula, because they're both properties that we've seen before, but it's interesting that they're both coming back.
Yeah, well, coming back, I wouldn't say the Dracula that you're going to see, the story that we're telling is really coming back, because it's the untold story of the origins of Dracula. So we're not just focusing on the vampire, we're focusing on the man behind the vampire. So we're actually basing the beginning of the film in the real world, in the world of Transylvania in the 1400s, 1480s. Where we meet Vlad Tepes, who was a man that, you know, was a king of his country, who was a ruler. He could be a very just ruler, but he could also be a very harsh ruler and quite a vicious disciplinarian. But you meet this man and you discover his life and the reasons why he makes decisions in his life and the sacrifices he makes that make him turn him into this creature that we know all so well as Dracula, which is the sort of the daddy of all vampires. But it's about his journey and it's about what happens in his life and that we focus on solely, you know, because it's the untold story. We're starting at the beginning. You know, there's a long way to go with Dracula. He's lived for a very long time, so we're better to start than the beginning.
Do you get to wear anything as insane as Gary Oldman's battle armor? From the
I can't say. I would be giving it away. But you know, it's a very famous armor that, so it's very much part of the legacy of Dracula. So who knows? And then playing the Crow, obviously that's an incredibly exciting responsibility, knowing the amount of attention the original film got and the huge fan base that it still has, and people hold it very dearly to their hearts because of the sadness behind the story of the creating of The Crow, because of poor Brandon Lee died making it. So I feel a huge sense of responsibility, and I'm surrounded by a very, very loyal team of people that care very much about telling the story and adding parts to the story that were never told the first time round. We're going back to the, basically back to the comic source material. We're not turning this into a Hollywood movie. We're keeping it solely based on what you read in the book. And that was never done the first time round. There's a lot that was missing. And so we're putting all that back in, which is very exciting, which it means it isn't, we're not just redoing the story that's been told. We're telling a story and adding the stuff that was never in it the first time.
Interesting. We've just done a list of the 20 greatest set pieces of the year, and Fast 6 is included in there.
That's awesome.
The nuts runway chase.
Oh my God, yeah.
I wanted to ask what it was like making that.
I mean, the aeroplane that we worked on, they built a life-size interior of an Antonov Russian cargo plane, and it was in a metal structure that was on then on suspension, air pocket suspension cushions, so that they could shake it, and so that we would work on it. Was like the plane was taking off down a runway, you know, and it was an extraordinary set piece actually. And who was to know that there was a runway that long?
We actually calculated how long it is.
38 miles, isn't it?
No, I think it was about 14.
Oh, 14
miles.
Miles, I think. Oh, 14
it was.
Miles. Oh,
so that's... about from here to Heathrow.
Mm. Maybe in the next one.
It's a big plane, the guy's a big plane. There's a lot of heavyweights on that plane. It could have been, you know, you had Vin Diesel, you had The Rock, you had that giant man on my side. I mean, that's a lot of weight.
Take time to take off, yeah.
Come on.
We've got to go now, but couple of very quick questions. I wondered what your film of the year was, and also what you'd like for Christmas.
Oh, do you know what? I hate questions like film of the year, because then I feel like I'm upsetting everybody else. I'd tell you the film that really got me... I got really wrapped up. There was two actually, and I loved Prisoners. I thought it was a great movie. I was totally immersed in it. And I thought Captain Phillips was really great. Really, really good performances all round. Not just Mr. Hanks, who obviously did a great job, but I felt that the Somali cast were really, really good. Christmas present. I'm giving myself a Christmas present of a holiday. I'm going away for Christmas. I'm disappearing somewhere warm, and I'm going to sit on a beach and frazzle.
Very nice. Well, I hope you have a wonderful time.
Thanks, somewhere buddy. With no fish.
No, I think there's plenty of fish. I hope so. I like fish.
Merry Christmas. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Luke.
All the best.
Thanks.
Lovely Luke Evans. Was he good, Phil? Nice guy?
Lovely man.
Lilting Welsh accent.
Lovely Welsh accent.
Lovely, lovely, lovely Luke Evans. Okay, time for the reviews. Let's be honest, really, review, as very few films have been brave enough to stand up to the might of The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. So, that's where we'll start. Helen.
Well, yes. Yeah, so we rejoin our heroes. They're still in the wilds, just over the Misty Mountains, which is about as far as they got last time. They're trying to find a way through warg and goblin infested lands to get to the also scary Mirkwood. What? And they have to cross that to get to the Lonely Mountain, which is where Smaug lives with all his treasure.
Great.
Yeah.
Excellent.
That's the setup.
That's the setup. Yeah. Very, very good. So the first film last year... came out, did very, very well, had made a billion, but I sense it not, I really liked it, but the sense that not everyone was as in love with that movie as they were with Peter Jackson's original Lord of the Rings trilogy. Does this movie put right any of the wrongs of that first film?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the tone is more kind of consistently ringsy, if you will, than that one was. I mean, I think last time... because The Hobbit is a different book, it's a much more childish book, it's a much simpler book, and it's a much funnier book. They brought some of that into the film, and you had stuff like the dishwashing song, and you had, you know, a lot of joking around and kind of pratfalling and that kind of thing. This time they've done away with a lot of that, and the focus is very much more on adventure. It's much more serious, and it is much more ringsy, and that is a sort of an impression that's bolstered by the presence of the wood elves. We get to go to basically Legolas's dad's kingdom. And see not only Leggy himself, but also Thranduil, who's played by Lee Pierce, Thranduil, who's played by Lee Pace, Tauriel, who's played by Evangeline Lilly, and etc. And it just begins, it does begin to feel a lot more ringsy, and that's even before you get to the Lonely Mountain, which you do in this film. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. You will get there, you will see a certain dragon. So it's got a bit more kind of epic scale, it's got a lot more kind of seriousness, and it's got a lot more kind of I think, action than the first one did.
Yeah, it hits the ground running. The first movie obviously took about an hour to leave Bilbo's kitchen. This movie really hits the ground running. There's a lovely scene at the very, very beginning. No spoilers, obviously. It's the very beginning of the movie between Gandalf and Thorin Oakenshield, played by Richard Armitage, who you'll be hearing very, very soon after this review, in fact. And that's really, really nice. It's a sort of a prologue, if you will, that takes place before the first movie that sets up Thorin's quest and his relationship with Gandalf. And then it really does hit the ground running with the dwarves and Bilbo and Gandalf being chased relentlessly by Azog the Defiler and his never-ending supply of orcs. I mean, this guy seriously has an inexhaustible supply of henchmen. It's quite cool.
And we should mention as well that the necromancer comes into it. He was kind of hinted at last time we saw Gandalf visiting the ruins of Dol Guldur, which are his stronghold. This time we see that there's really something quite sinister going on there, and it kind of sets up what I think is going to be a very big confrontation in the third film, and also ties this a little bit more closely together with Lord of the Rings.
I think this comes on leaps and bounds from the first film. I have lots of very encouraging and very exciting things to talk about. You want to leave the film and say, hey, this is great, but you've got to see it, there's this, and then that happens, and this is great, and oh, when he does that, it's fantastic, and Martin Freeman is brilliant yet again, he's fantastic.
Yeah. I do feel the focus is lost on him slightly. It obviously comes back greatly towards the end, but there are sequences in this movie where he's off screen for a long, long time.
Focus is a problem generally with this film. It is a kid's story, and it is very much A to B to C to D to E to F to G to mountain to dragon to and so on. So there is a certain amount of, oh, we're now in this section, we're now in this section. It's very beat by beat by beat, but some of the beats are incredible. I'm sure you've heard, if you've spoken to anybody about this film, he's already seen it, that the barrel sequence is outstanding. In fact, it has the moment this year where I have laughed the most continuously.
Really?
I laugh continuously for about 20 seconds.
The bit with the person spinning around? That was fantastic.
That's quite funny.
It gets the comedy right again. It's action and it's surprising, and there's a confidence and excitement. You can tell when Peter Jackson's going, I love this, let's go for it. The spiders in Mirkwood is fantastic. Smaug, who's voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch, is chilling and looks outstanding. It's a glorious,
great work. Yeah.
Giant, like, they have to create obviously this huge building to house him in, the under the mountain is just so well done. I love how they create this dwarven halls. It's like the Mines of Moria, but like more so, and the gold is stunning. And I honestly, if I could say one thing again about this film, I said about the first one, but Martin Freeman's fantastic when he's in the mountain. He does things. There are some little beats, little clever moments where you know it's from him. He's bringing it, and so he's very good indeed. Mm. At the same time, there are lots of niggles I have, and a part of them I would have to lay at Tolkien's door. It's not necessarily Jackson's fault. It's just that this book isn't necessarily that well suited to be made into a film, because, like I say, there's so much going on. There's so much to touch on, to deal with, and certain decisions that Jackson's made to bring people in and tie plots together aren't necessarily to my taste. But for the most part, I really enjoy this film. It has its flaws. You will be talking about things that you didn't like as well as things that you did. But all in all, this is an absolute riot. And there are about four or five moments where you will, for my money, think, well, that's why I paid to go and see it in the cinema.
If there are flaws, it would be that they should just be more ruthless in the editing room, I would say. But I enjoyed it a lot more as well than the first one. I think there's an acceptance even from some of the people involved in the film that this is a real step up in quality. And drama from An Unexpected Journey, and it has stakes, real sense of jeopardy, which the first film didn't really have, where it just felt like a bit of a, if you compare the Goblin King escape to the barrel sequence, you felt that was fun and I laughed, and it was, you know, it was brilliantly choreographed, and props to Joe Letteri and the Weta Digital effects work on that, because it's just spectacular. But you know, the first film, that Goblin chase, just felt like, I just didn't really
mild
make it.
Diversion.
It was boring, and you never felt anyone was in any danger. Whereas with this one, I felt a little bit more exhilarated by it all. And when they came out the other side, you felt a sense of relief and all the things you should feel in a big adventure. Some of the Lake Town stuff, I was a little disappointed with. I don't think that was necessarily Peter Jackson. You know, people say he's not great at the love story stuff. You can see that in his filmography, pretty much, apart from maybe King Kong,
which
is a little different.
Clearly.
Meet the Feebles. But there is this little love story in there, which I quite enjoyed. I thought it had a nice chemistry. Quite chaste, obviously, but The Lake Town stuff is, I thought, a little. They could have done more with it. They could have. This idea, this human community, which makes you think, for the first time in Middle Earth, you see how humans deal with all this craziness around them, and yet you had slightly two-dimensional characters like the Master.
Stephen Fry.
Played brilliantly by Stephen Fry and flamboyantly so and great to watch, but at the same time, the character is not that interesting.
I actually loved Lake Town. I think I wanted more of it, maybe. But I think that felt like something we're going to see more of when there's an extended edition of this, and or next time. I think we're going to be going back to Lake Town at the beginning of the next film, I suspect.
To look at, production design-wise, fantastic.
Incredible. Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. And the detailing is remarkable. And we were on set, and it's something that they wrote about in the magazine, and every, to the nth degree, all of the, you know, and that comes across in the whole. But I just thought that the politicking and the fact that they're torn between the gold and the avarice, and knowing that they've got this beast can come out and destroy them, it could have been more sophisticatedly handled. There's one particular scene which I had a bit of a problem with.
There's interesting depth and shape being introduced into the franchise at this point. Thorin Oakenshield is becoming a much more complicated character than perhaps he was first time around. Although I liked him first time around, he's got a lot of depth to him. He's not the necessarily straight up heroic dwarf that you would think he might be on first viewing. And I like that. I think Martin Freeman is very, very nicely sketching out Bilbo's corruption at the hands of the Ring as well. His confrontation with Smaug at the end is fantastic. There's a lot to really, really like about this movie, and I think Lord of the Rings fans will feel comfortable with this film.
And there are some lovely throwbacks in this. I mean, the very opening scene, which is an addition from the book, but one that I think works really well, has Gandalf meeting Thorin in Bree before the start of the last film, before, you know, it's the two of them getting together. And you go back to the Prancing Pony, right, and the set is just as it was.
And the first person we see in this movie is, well, I won't say.
Yes,
it's a lovely little touch.
And it was actually really, really pleasant to be back on that set. But it wasn't just a scene that was there for nostalgia value. It was a scene that really actually kind of moved the plot forward and explained something about Thorin in a slightly different light than we see in the book that actually I think works very well for this version of the character. So you'll see exactly what I mean when you see it, but I don't want to spoil everything because it's a really lovely little beat.
Yes, and it is virtually non-stop action as well. As you mentioned, the Spiders of Mirkwood sequence is fantastic. There's the barrel sequence, which is great. The whole Smaug sequence is a wonderful set piece. So there's a really, really lot to love about this. I do feel it suffers slightly from middle film syndrome. And it is very, very much a setup for the next movie, but hey ho, it is fantastic. We gave it 5 stars. It's a wonderful spectacle. Do check it out on the biggest screen you can possibly find, not your iPhone if you can. That'd be great. And if you want to hear us dig further into The Hobbit: The Desolation of Smaug, because we've been tiptoeing around spoilers like crazy here, our spoiler special podcast will be up, all being well, on, and I'm looking at Ali here, Monday.
I'd say late Monday.
Late Monday, maybe Tuesday at a. If everything goes horribly wrong. Okay, but we're recording it tomorrow. It won't just have us banging on about it, though, you'll be pleased to hear. We'll have spoiler-filled interviews with Jimmy Nesbitt, hello.
Stop doing your impression.
Hello, Jimmy Nesbitt. And Bilbo himself, Martin Freeman. No, okay. So that's definitely one to look out for. And there are some other films out this week. There's The Christmas Candle, which marks a big screen debut. Hello, I'm Susan Boyle. Subo. Sue's album party.
Yes. Please stop there.
Album party.
Yes. It's actually pretty not brilliant. We've called it Indigestible Christmas Stodge in our review, so be warned. Which is a shame because it has Leslie Manville, Sylvester McCoy, and Samantha Barks in. All people we wish well of. Please don't bark, Chris.
Sorry. That's some terrible barks.
But it basically involves a vicar rediscovering his faith in miracles and magical candles bestowed by angels, which is all a bit odd. So, it might have worked sort of 70 years ago, but not so much nowadays.
Mind you, we have been just talking about a film in which a bunch of dwarfs are chasing a dragon for money.
Yeah, but dragons make sense. Come on.
You and
vicars
the
are
dragons.
Just mythical.
If you love dragons so much, why don't you just go and live with one in a big castle under the ground filled with money?
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. If anyone can arrange this, do write into Helen. So that's Christmas Candle. And then this week marks the re-release of the wonderful Cinema Paradiso. Still brilliant, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Yes, well
definitely.
Done.
Go see it, if only for the kiss montage. It is one of the greats. And that is also a 5-star film.
5 stars. Is that it this week? Anything else?
Pretty much.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, mm-hmm. There you go. So 5 stars for The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, 5 stars for Cinema Paradiso, The Re-Release, and 5 stars for Christmas Candle. 2 stars for The Christmas Candle. And now it is time for our last interview with Hobbit stalwart Richard Armitage, a.k.a. the would-be under the king, a.k.a. the would-be king under the mountain himself. He is, of course, Thorin Oakenshield, and he was speaking to Helen and Phil. Lovely. Enjoy this. What's wrong? What's wrong?
You're just saying enjoy this.
Enjoy this.
Enjoy.
It's like a threat with a gun.
Enjoy this.
Enjoy it.
Please enjoy it. Please.
Enjoy
please
this.
Enjoy it.
Beren and the Prancing Pony, having been a sort of Lord of the Rings obsessive, and they built the entire set, you know, the whole walk down and the pub. It's one of those locations that should be a permanent building somewhere on the planet that you can go and have a pint in the Prancing Pony.
Definitely. It was really nice to be back there. I was actually kind of surprised when as soon as the camera went through the door, I was like, oh, it's this place again. Great.
Yeah, Ian and I spent 2 days in that scene. It took 2 days to shoot, and I could have stayed there for a week. It was great. It was a really nice place.
Wow. And that scene is important because, you know, this isn't, I don't think, too much of a spoiler because it is the very opening of the film. So that sets up exactly why the Arkenstone matters so much to Thorin, because in the book it just does. There's no real explanation given. But here he's given a little more context. It's not just, oh, it's a big shiny jewel.
Yeah, and I think they really wanted to differentiate between the sort of obsessive power of the ring and the Arkenstone. The Arkenstone is more of a talisman. It's more of a, with, if you hold the Arkenstone, you have the right to rule, and you can also call on other dwarf armies to rally to the cause, which is going to happen in movie 3. He's going to have to call on some other dwarves to come help him fight. But also, I think in that scene, you're setting up a sense that Gandalf is working on a greater political agenda, and you see that when he goes to Dol Guldur. And again, he's, you know, critics or purists would possibly look at that and think, why are we looking at Dol Guldur and why are we seeing this orc army gathering? And again, it slingshots into movie 3 when at the Battle of the Five Armies, it's not just random armies that turn up. They've all got an agenda. So yeah. Really enjoyable scene to shoot.
Yeah, definitely. And it gives it a bit of more of a connection to the tissue of the other three films as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It ties everything a bit more together. Yeah.
Thorin feels like, to me, like he was kind of coming out of himself a little bit at the end of an unexpected journey. And he feels like he's got a bit more of that. He's disappeared into himself a little bit more again, perhaps in this film, as the quest weighs him down. Is that fair?
That might be something to do with a kind of inconsistency in shooting, because the new ending to movie 1 was a construction. It was a much later opening. It was a much later softening, should I say. But it's something that I actually really like. Normally in movies, you sort of iron out all the inconsistencies and make things rational. And I like the fact that Thorin is a little bit unpredictable. He is changing. He is sort of questioning himself more when the quest becomes his and Gandalf leaves and he has to take control and things really start to go wrong. I think it's quite humiliating for him. The Hobbit is proving to be his greatest asset because he's getting them out of so many sticky situations. And so by the time they reach the secret door, Thorin's view of Bilbo has really changed from Bag End. And I think, again, as we go into the next film where that relationship becomes really intense, they do sort of get to a good place.
When we spoke to you on the podcast this time last year for the first film, you came up with this brilliant phrase.
Was it about being a dwarf?
Yeah, was it dwarf manatee.
Dwarf manatee, as in humanity.
It was awful. When we spoke to you this time last year for the first film, you came up with this brilliant phrase, dwarf manatee, as in like the dwarf equivalent of humanity of these characters. But in this case, you think he's been sort of emasculated, whatever the equivalent of that would be, a little bit.
Yeah, he's finding his hobbit manatee. Yeah. His prejudices, I guess, are falling away. But, by the end of the film, of this second film, he's entered the mountain. So the effect, you see, there's a very sort of curtailed moment where Thorin sees the gold for the first time and it starts to course through him. And there's an irrational beginning when he says to Bilbo, "Did you find the Arkenstone?" And you can see confusion in Thorin as to how he's behaving. So, yeah, I think he's changed in his views, but it's going to get a lot more confusing for him and me.
Right. What is that, depending on what scenes they add to number three as well?
Yeah, we may go back next year and shoot some more, but, you know, I would willingly get on a plane and go to New Zealand anytime, yeah.
I mean, it was interesting as well to me, and again, in that opening scene, we get a little bit more of a hint of his background. You see that he's been hunted and, you know, there's a price on his head. He's literally, you know, a wanted man. And also that he's looking for his father. You get a little bit more of that as well, that this, you know, this damaged man is wandering the wilderness somewhere, and that's kind of eating away at Thorin a little bit as well.
You really paid attention, didn't you?
I did.
Very interesting that, yeah, we are reminded that he's being pursued. And I think that was something, again, which was added by the filmmaker, just because I think it ramps up the tension. You know, they can't rest anywhere for too long. I think there will be an extended edition, because we shot a flashback in that first sequence where you see Thorin losing his father on the battlefield. And again, I think the scene has been cut from movie two, where Gandalf finds Thrain in Dol Guldur. Whether that's going to turn up in movie three, I don't know. But it's a difficult thread to follow, because it would have been a flashback in a flashback. And that's a kind of weird way to start the film. But it was interesting for me to know that was what was in Thorin's mind, this sort of obsession of his father that has disappeared 100 years to the day before they set out on the quest. And he never finds out what happened to him. And you know, it galvanizes the fact that Thorin is the last of the line of Durin. And if he fails to retake the mountain, then it's, you know, the line of Durin dies. Mm. It's a big obligation, yeah.
He's quite sweary in this film, isn't he? Can you teach us some
sweary? He is very sweary.
Can you teach us the dwarf swear word?
Oh, there's two great little phrases which they didn't subtitle. What he says to, it's actually both in relation to Thranduil, because I think Thranduil really gets Thorin's goat for obvious reasons. He says to Thranduil, Imri Damradur Sul. The literal translation is dire death of flames, so it means burn in hell. And then the other one is Ishkakvi ein Gorgnul, which a rough translation of that is I pour excrement on the beard of your, or on the heads of your ancestors or your kin. So I'm shit in your face, basically. Yeah.
Have you used it in conversation since the film?
I occasionally drop it in sometimes if someone's annoying me.
And they look
it's
slightly
a bit rude.
Slightly befuddled.
Dwarves are terribly rude, though.
They are, aren't they? They're not the most refined species of Middle Earth, I think it's fair to say.
You had some unusual experience in the Tokyo premiere of the first film, where you were given microphones and there was talk of perhaps doing some ad-lib, sort of improvised singing.
Japanese ad-libbing. Yeah. Oh, improvised singing. We didn't do that, did we?
I don't think you did it, but it was, you know, it was on the cards at one point. Have you had any strange experiences in the Eye of the Hobbit promotional storm since then?
Not with singing this year, no.
What's the theme this year?
I'm just trying to think of a theme that's come through this year. Oh, yeah, most people kind of come in and say, wow, you're really tall, when I'm sitting in a chair. And I'm like, how can you tell I'm sitting down? I think it's confusing people. I think it's mainly that recognition thing. Most people don't assimilate that character in me, which is brilliant. It's everything I could possibly want from a role, is to transform into what that character looks like away from myself. Yeah,
a bit handy for walking around the street as well, I
yeah,
guess, if people
I think
aren't.
We leave the singing this year to Ed Sheeran. Have you heard that song?
I have. It
isn't
really
it
nice.
Amazing?
Yeah, good. Really good.
So first film was Neil Finn, this one was Ed Sheeran. What would be your dream artist for the third film?
Kylie Minogue. No, I'm kidding. I think she's great, but not for this movie. I don't know. I think they've gone along a folk theme. They really have. So I don't know, maybe somebody like Laura Marling, I think, would be kind of interesting. But if you notice, each song seems to be wrapped around a character. So I've got a feeling that with the third film, the song is going to be something to do with going home. And it will be probably from Bilbo's point of view. So I don't know. I suspect a male voice, probably, but who can tell at this point? Maybe we should run a competition.
That would be fun. We should do that. When we already get people to design posters on the website, there's no reason we shouldn't get them writing songs as well. You know, let's just get them to do the work for us. I wanted to ask about the barrel ride, though, because it was brilliantly fun to watch, but it looks like it was kind of horrific to shoot. I mean, has it put you off log flumes for life?
I have to say, there were many horrors of this film, but the barrel sequence was not one of them. Okay. On one of those rare occasions where the dwarves weren't whinging. because the stuff in the river, the Polaris River, was just glorious. We were cool for the first time in forever because we were in these unsinkable barrels which were filled with water. So they were kind of riding low in the water. So you were in water in a barrel, if you see what I mean. The day was great and we were flowing. I mean, it wasn't a particularly fast flowing river, but we were certainly moving and catching the current. So we were having little races to see who could get to the end first. Amazing. I mean, one of the few times that Thorin actually smiled. Then we went into a studio into what can only be described as, a fairground ride. It was like a water course powered by V8 engines. And it had different settings, 1 to 10. The fastest that they tested it at was about 7. And it was, the engines would burn out. And by the end of the week, we were screaming for it to be at 10 because it was so much fun. And it was interesting because they would dump, tons of water on top of us as well to sort of replicate the waterfall. And then we were doing close-up shots in sort of wheel barrels, where you pedaled it with your own feet so you could kind of on dry land. But at every step of the way, it was so much fun to shoot. And I do think you can see that in the filming of it. I think, although it looks treacherous, there's a certain glee from the dwarves, which you really need because they're escaping. So,
just to move away from The Hobbit for a second, we're just looking at some of your early... Well, actually, more recently than that, IMDb credits, and one of them is Miss Marple. Something called Ordeal by Innocence. What the hell does that mean?
I have no idea. I actually don't really know much about that particular story as well. I think I turned up, did my bits, and didn't read the rest of the script. But I was playing I was in a wheelchair, which was a really interesting thing to do with a director that really, she was amazing, but she didn't quite understand that wheelchairs don't go upstairs. And I remember being on set and there were a few sort of small staircases because it was actually a real house that wasn't built. And she'd sort of say to me, so you can come in through this door and kind of come down the corridor. And there were like a flight of stairs. And I'd say to her, I don't know how I'm quite going to do this. And she just didn't get it. So... That was an ordeal by wheelchair.
So what did you do? How did you get out?
I just stayed at the bottom of the staircase, and I think I got out of the chair, pulled the chair to the top, and then carried on wheeling. And they just cut that bit out.
So you didn't do it then? What? It wasn't you. You committed the crime.
I think it was me. Actually, I know. I definitely.
Surely
I definitely killed Lisa Stansfield, who was playing my wife. And she refused to sing Been Around the World in IIAI. She just wouldn't sing it. And I think that's why my character killed her.
That's amazing.
I think any jury in the land would surely
understand. You don't expect
Lisa
Stansfield to turn up in a Marple, though, do you? But it was glorious.
This really happened. All of that really happened.
Yeah, really happened.
It must have been like a cheese dream looking back.
You haven't seen it, have you? You just looked at the credit.
I did look at the credit.
You're going to go watch it now, though.
Yeah, it's on YouTube, so we can watch that. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to just work out and I'm going to complain about your ability to go up and downstairs.
Yeah, this magical wheelchair that floats.
Yeah.
We do something called IMD Bunker sometimes because obviously not all the information on there is accurate. So we like
to check. I'd say maybe 99% of it is not accurate. But
also possible. Is it true that you worked in the circus?
That is true,
as a young man? What was your speciality?
I did a bit of everything actually, but I was very, very good at throwing hula hoops to a Russian skateboarding girl.
And then
I didn't
do
the skateboard. She hula hooped with like millions of hula hoops on a skateboard. It was in the 80s, so it was obviously quite... No, maybe it was early. No, it was the 80s. But yeah, I was throwing hula hoops. I wasn't a highly skilled circus artist at all.
You didn't work with bears?
No bears, but there were the remnants of some elephants, not the remains. That sounds really dark, doesn't it? I think elephants slept somewhere because I could smell them the whole time. It's the bottom rung of show business, also known as the arsehole of show business.
This was in Budapest, is that in Hungary?
Yeah.
How did that come about? How did you end up in Hungary in the circus?
I sort of wanted to be in show business and I'd been to a school and, I needed an equity card so I could go to open auditions. And so the principal of that school, who's sadly passed on, got me a contract in this crazy circus and I got an equity card from it.
So it all worked out in the end?
It all worked out in the end. And then I think it was about 10 years later, I ended up back in Budapest shooting Robin Hood and went to visit the circus. And lots of memories came flooding back.
Was anybody still there that you knew?
No, but the circus is a permanent stone building. So it was very strange going back.
I also wanted to ask, is it true that you're named after Richard III?
That is true, yes. My father was really into the history of the Plantagenets, and I was born on 22nd of August, which is the Battle of Bosworth Field, when Richard died on the battlefield. I was always a bit mad at my dad because for naming me after what was perceived to be a hunchback child murderer. But then in later years, I just developed a similar interest in the story because we used to visit there every year on my birthday. Thanks, Dad. That was my birthday treat to go and just look at an empty field. But yeah, and then in recent months, his remains have been found, so it's all kind of coming to the surface again.
Quite literally.
Literally.
When you said you began to share his interest, I was worried you meant the child murdering and the hunchback.
No, no. No, definitely not that. Although, but the fascination with the sort of unsolved crime, I did become kind of interested in not necessarily resurrecting his heroicism, but just looking at the story again, because he was our last monarch that died on a battlefield. And it's interesting how I'm sort of playing a character that's not dissimilar to him in Thorin. So I was using a bit of that, you know, character in Thorin, yeah.
Do you have yourself in Lego?
I do. And what's really good is I've seen the second movie Lego, which is Thorin stripped of his, after the elven dungeons where they get all of their clothes stripped off of them. So he's in, it's not a naked Lego, but he's in just a sort of skinny little shift, if you can call that, if you can imagine that in Lego.
Are you pretty buff in Lego?
Yeah, I mean, quite square shouldered.
And your head rotates like 360.
It does, yeah.
But it's Christmas Day.
I can actually do that though. Shall I show you?
Do it.
Hang on, okay, here we go.
He's doing it.
Oh my God.
And back around the other side.
Amazing, Richard.
Incredible.
The circus. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
You're welcome.
Best of luck with
you. Thanks.
That is it for this week's Empire Podcast. How was he, Helen, by the way? Is he good?
He was nice lovely. Yeah, lovely.
That is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for the very last podcast of the year.
Apart from the other ones, but yeah.
Podcast proper, the one that, you know, this one. The one that's out every Friday, not the specials that we chain you to your desk and make you do. Those ones. Well, we'll be joined by another triple whammy of guests. I don't know if you noticed the use of the word triple there. From Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues, we'll have Adam McKay, the writer and director, and Judd Apatow, the producer. There's also J.C. Chandor, director of the brilliant All Is Lost, and David O. Russell, here to talk about his new movie, American Hustle.
That rhymes.
It does rhyme, doesn't it? Yeah. So how's that for an early Christmas present? That is something to keep you going over the holidays. And that won't be all, of course. Don't forget to look out for the Hobbit Spoiler special next week. And then just after Christmas, our Review of the Year mega podcast, which should be a lot of fun. So until next week, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
Goodbye from Ali.
Bye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Enjoy it. Sorry. Goodbye.
It's enjoy this.
Enjoy this. Sorry. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get a hug from Phil. See you next week. Bye. Come here, you big kid.
No!
Oh.